is they're trying to get their arms around the plan that CAPS had put together and how exactly ACIR might support that effort. So with that, I'll call to order the meeting and just remind folks again that this is a publicly accessible meeting. If you wish to be recognized to speak, either have your camera on and wave or use the raise hand function. And otherwise, this will be recorded for posterity and for public information. Our next item on the agenda was a discussion of the January 26th meeting notes, if necessary. Bruce, I think we're good on that, right? We don't really have, do we have any specifics about that? We're not taking minutes of our subcommittees, per se. So we take notes of those subcommittee meetings, and to the extent that folks have looked at them or have thoughts or issues with how they are being presented, we'll be holding on to them, but we're not necessarily needing a vote in any way for those, since we're not really taking minutes precisely. Is that a fair summarization, Bruce, of that?
That is correct. I wrote them almost as if they were minutes, and people who participated in the meeting had a couple weeks or more to review and respond. There were no responses. I will post them as meeting notes, and anyone who would rather spend a few minutes reading rather than watching an hour and a half recording is free to go to those.
Yes, okay. I did have a suggestion from Deborah to identify ourselves on this subcommittee meeting as to where we are affiliated. So I don't know if we want to just kind of go through the room real quickly and identify ourselves as to who we are and who we represent, and whether or not we are ACIR members officially, or whether we're here to participate to the discussion. So, John, you're in my upper left corner on my screen, so why don't you go? I'll just identify myself. I'm Brendan Sharkey. I'm the chair of the ACIR. And I see my chair, Lau Ray, is here as well.
I'm John Filchak. I am an ACIR member appointed by the President Pro Tem. My day job is I'm the Executive Director of the Northeastern Connecticut Council of Governments.
I am Lon Seibman. I'm the Chairman of the Essex Board of Education, and I'm also CABE's delegation to the ACIR, or delegate.
Marcia?
I'm Marcia LeClaire, Mayor of the Town of East Hartford.
Kathy Dempsey, I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the State Department of Education, and I am a voting member of ACIR.
Brian, I'll just name you off individuals. Sorry.
Sure. Oh, go ahead.
Brian Greenleaf. I'm the Director of Finance and Operations for the Ellington Public Schools and designee of the Minority Leader to ACIR.
Maureen Brummett, Superintendent of Schools in Newington and representative from CAPS.
Great. Deborah?
I'm Deborah Barrero from Capital Region Education Council. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Strategic Planning.
Okay. And Fran, good to see you. You're joined us.
Hi. Thank you, Brendan. It's good to see all of you, and thank you for doing this. I'm Fran Rabinowitz. I'm the Executive Director for Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. I'm not a member of ACIR. No. But right. It would be great if I were, but thank you.
See what we can do, Fran.
Well, yeah. There's some vacancies, so.
Yeah.
Brian.
Brian O'Connor. I'm with CCM. I'm their Director of Public Policy.
And I am Ron Thomas's designee.
And Terry, you're next.
Hi, I'm Terry Marisotis. I'm from AFT Connecticut. I'm a lobbyist for AFT Connecticut. I'm not a voting member, but I've been invited to come to because it's education. So thank you very much for inviting me. Thanks.
Rick.
Yeah, Rick Hart. I'm the labor representative appointed by the governor, and my day job, I'm a deputy chief in the Waterbury Fire Department.
Rick Porth.
Morning, everybody. Rick Porth from the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities.
And Susan, you were there pre-meeting, but maybe you could just ID yourself for everyone.
I am Susan Heller-Williams. I lobby for CEA.
And Ray is right next to you on my screen.
Ray Rocamondo, Director of Research, Policy, and Government Relations, also for CEA.
Great. Bruce, your disembodied voice graced us earlier, but just so you could identify yourself.
Sure, I'm Bruce Wickson of OPM, not a member of ACIR, but take the notes and set up things.
Our intrepid staff. Supporter. Leah.
Good morning. Leah Grenier from State Department of Education. I'm Kathy Dempsey's alternate.
Great. Let's see. Who are we missing? Danny
Medris, Political Director, CSEA, SEIU, Local 2001.
Thank you. Lyle, I introduced you for you, but you should...
Thanks. Lyle Ray, Deputy Chair of ACIR. As John was saying, my day job, I'm Executive Director of the Capital Region Council of Governments. Good to be here.
And we have one other person with just a phone number, the 860-712-4750. If you're with us, could you just ID yourself?
If they're phone only, you may have to unmute them.
I see. Lyle, that may be on you, right? Because you've got the controls on that, right? Let's see. Okay. We'll stay, I guess, anonymous for the time being, for our mystery phone caller. I don't know, Lyle, if that's something that is on your end. I wonder if that's the caller's preference.
I can ask to unmute, which is all it will let me do. So I hit that button.
Okay. Well, maybe if they join us, maybe later on we can in there again. Okay, so the purpose, we at our last full meeting of the ACIR, we heard a presentation that was very, I think, concise but comprehensive from Fran about this new study proposal coming from CAPS, again, called the Blueprint to Transform Connecticut Public Schools. It's a very far-ranging, wide-ranging proposal that has a lot of very interesting and I think exciting suggestions as to how best to reimagine how we're doing local education here in Connecticut. And at the meeting, we had resolved that we would kick this to our subcommittee for further discussion of some of the details, and then kind of get our heads around how we as a body in ACIR might either choose to support and recommend CAPS's proposals to the administration and to the legislature, but also kind of figure out how best we could use our influence towards that end, assuming again that the full body is in alignment with that. It seemed from the presentation at our last full meeting that there was general support for what CAPS has put together. But of course, the devil's in the details, and that's the purpose of the subcommittee, to kind of dig into it a little bit further without taking it, you know, spending hours on it, obviously, in this meeting, but really try to get a sense of the main features of this that we as a body should really be thinking about as to whether we can support it and also how to support it as we go. So maybe it makes sense, and Fran is here to with us, if Fran, you could just do a very brief re-summarization of the plan and what you think are the pros and cons, as well as some of the potential landmines that you might be recommending we step on.
Okay, thank you, Brendan, and thank you all for entertaining the idea of supporting the blueprint. Let me just go back and say again that this has been 3 years in the making. I worked on it closely with Ted Sergi, former Commissioner of Education, and Kathy Gay, former officer of OPM. I began to work on it in summer of 2018 when the ECS formula that's presently in existence right now came out, and 95 towns were losing dollars. And we felt strongly that we needed to come forward with an ECS formula that made sense. With that said, we began the journey. It quickly became apparent to us that ECS on its own as a silo would not be the best way to move forward. We've done that so many times. You've looked at districts, and everybody looks at their district and sees what their district gets, and then they decide whether they're in favor or not in favor of ECS, the ECS formula. So we felt that we ought to look at it in the context of all of the state funding, but also in the context of municipalities, in the context of education programming. We also recommend some repurposing of dollars in the budget, so it's not give us everything. And it is also a piece on accountability. So I'll be very quick. ECS, we're looking at 2.5% per year. We're looking at, please think about raising the foundation of ECS as well as we move forward. It's a 15-year plan, guys, and every superintendent in Connecticut is in agreement with this plan. They're not in agreement with every single recommendation in the plan, but they are in consensus about the plan. It goes into the ECS funding. It talks about predictability of funding. It talks about excess cost funding, both at the federal level and at the state level. And it then goes into many of the education programming issues that we think need attention in Connecticut. For example, it looks at structural racism. It looks at implicit bias. It looks at training for that. It looks at special ed. Why is it that we have increased exponentially in special ed numbers? We've gone from 11% of the population in 2011 to 16%, now almost 17% right now, and in some districts, 25%. It is now a quarter of the general budget in many districts. It looks at school construction. It looks at adult education. And I can drill down on all of these. You've heard a lot about social emotional development of children. It is definitely included in there, as well as a request for funding. And we're working, when I talk about this, we're also working at the federal level. I sit in Rosa DeLauro's kitchen cabinet. I spoke to Rosa last week about the need for federal funding to be focused on social and emotional. Talks about teacher certification. Talks about teacher eval in this area. We've embarked on a teacher evaluation system that isn't what we need it to be. And so, you know, we need to work harder on getting a better evaluation system. We also need to work harder on removing some of the challenges that don't allow us to bring teachers in as quickly and as easily as we'd like to from other states. It does look at some state grant eliminations. There is about close to $3 million in the budget that have been gifts over time to districts for different areas or to programs, but they really haven't moved forward. They don't influence the whole state. And we're saying, could we take those and repurpose them? It certainly looks at federal funding and says, you know, come on, guys, you promised 40% of special ed funding. You're only giving us 14%. Make good on your promise. Talks about preschool, talks about governance and a code of conduct for Board of Ed members and the ability to remove Board of Ed members who aren't or who have egregiously violated that code. Talks about municipalities and says, listen, if municipalities are short funded, that affects education in a big way. School districts exist within municipalities. We are part and parcel of the municipality, and there's just so much money. Talks about school improvement grants, talks in a big way, and I'd like to even do more on this, about EL learners. EL students, English language learners, are coming in all of our districts, and we have to find better ways to make them more successful. We're incredibly concerned with the dropout numbers. Talks about school choice and tuition to magnet schools. Talks about the lack of equity in reimbursement for magnet schools. And it says, we can't solve that, guys, but we would suggest that there be no more magnets or other schools of choice built until we do figure that out. And talks about regionalism, and it talks about being able to be more, to be smarter in how we regionalize our work, especially through the RESCs. And there's a great deal more in here, but I know that your time is limited and I'll drill down on anything. But what I want to point out is our desire or our vision is to move this forward as a concept, as a plan. We understand it's a 15-year plan. We understand we're not going to get everything done right away. We have priorities for each year, many of which don't cost money, by the way. But we thought, wouldn't it be incredibly powerful as a state if we were all together around a plan that was comprehensive and focused at the same time? Right now, you've got well over 200 bills coming out of the Education Committee on different subjects. They're all very fragmented. Many of them are already exist in the blueprint. They're related to the blueprint. Could we get to get behind something and move it forward? And by the way, we are very open to negotiating on any of the recommendations. There are thoughts, but it doesn't stand as unchangeable. So that's where we are right now. And in light of the governor's budget, we certainly think it would be a good alternative for the legislature to take up in terms of the ECS funding. And I'll be glad to talk to more, answer questions, whatever, on any part of it.
Thanks, Fran. I will leave this entirely open to others to ask the questions that are on their minds. I'll take the a liberty in just asking you now, what is the reception that you're getting from the administration and from legislators about not just, well, this is a nice report, you know, thanks for doing it, but, you know, in terms of people actually saying, yeah, let's adopt this as a blueprint.
Well, I'm not getting, thank you. I'm not getting anyone to say, let's adopt it as a blueprint. I'm just being honest out here. That was very hard for me in the very beginning, because when I came out, when we issued it, I thought, wow, this is such a good idea. And not because it's mine, because trust me, it's not. Ted Sergi did a lot of this work. And I thought, wow. All superintendents agree. We've never had anything where we all agreed and were willing to move together. So I brought it to the governor's office. I would say to you that there was wonderful interest in it. I've talked to them two or three times, but there wasn't I was hoping, you know, we're not territorial. We would be happy to give it to the governor and say, this could be a great legacy plan for you moving forward. I didn't hear we're going to adopt it. I have, I've brought it to the legislature, to very many committees. I've brought it to the chairs of education, Doug McCrory, Bobby Sanchez, love it, said it's really good. Kathleen McCarty has worked tirelessly with me on this, really wants to see it move forward. I've worked with for a couple of hours with Kathy Austin. I've talked to Tony Walker on appropriations. We're going to attend the public hearing, but no one has grabbed it and said, let's move it forward as a concept. It's really interesting because most of the bills that they're moving forward are already in the blueprint. So I'm not sure of how to push further to make that happen. I'm just honest here. But I, you know, we'd like nothing more than to see that happen as a state. This is what Massachusetts does. You know, Ted and others have told me you've got to be patient. It may not all happen at once, but it would be, I just see it as such a boon for us moving forward as a state.
Yeah, well, and my unsolicited advice on that,
yeah,
from my experience is that, you know, it's it is going to be, you know, it's a long slog. It's also a lot for people to get their heads around.
Yes.
So to get an endorsement, a wholesale endorsement from anyone is probably unlikely, but if you could get organizations like ours, like the ACIR and others, you know, to embrace the concept, you know, you can start building the coalition of interests who are behind it. And from there, you know, then it becomes something that can be adopted by a governor or an administration or a legislature. But obviously, it's a vision thing, right?
Yes.
So, you know, nothing really happens without the governor getting behind it. You know, it's a big idea, which requires, as I tell my students at Central on public policy, right? Big things like this only happen when the governor gets behind it.
Right? So,
and to get the governor behind it, it seems to me you've got to build a coalition of folks who are joining with you in support. That's my own personal advice. I'm not speaking on behalf of anyone else. Maureen, I see your questions.
Thank you very much. Just to piggyback on that, you know, a lot of us CAPS members have reached out to our local legislators, in my case, Gary Turco and Senator Lesser, Representative Wood, and been very clear with them about the ECS funding in the current budget is absolutely unworkable. And if the CAPS plan were enacted at the 2.5% increase, everyone in the state would be, for lack of a better word, a winner. Many of us lose next year. Newington's going to lose 300 plus thousand. whereas other districts, because they aren't going to get the cut in the plan that was originally enacted, are sort of like winners. So but the blueprint allows us to all get a predictable increase every year. So I've kind of made a lot of my remarks around ECS just because that's something that we all know a lot about. And the current plan that the governor has submitted is just absolutely not productive for most districts. And similarly, he's using the ESSER monies that we're supposed to be getting as a way of kind of backfilling or, getting some help for our kids who've been, you know, missing out or regressing during this pandemic. He's sort of using that as an operating budget offset, which is not at all what was intended to do. And it really puts us all at a disadvantage, especially in a year that we're trying to recover from a pandemic. So just my two cents on the whole ECS matter.
And you couldn't be more right, Maureen, and that is what I'm hearing across the state.
Well, okay, so can I just, and I'm sorry to hold off, John, I know it's an interesting interest too. In terms of strategy,
yep.
There is, I think, almost universal opposition to I've been appointed chair of this commission by the governor, but I think there's, I'll say frankly that it seems like there is almost universal opposition to the way the governor has come forward in terms of his use of COVID relief funds for education, the way you described it, Maureen. And I'm wondering if yet no one really has the alternative. I'm wondering if this blueprint is potentially an alternative to the way the governor is approaching that funding, that maybe rather than stripping funds or pulling back operational funds from the general operating budget from boards of ed and from towns and then backfilling it with federal money, what if this plan could become the blueprint for, look, the state has to maintain its commitment as promised in its operating budget to the extent that we're getting additional federal money in support of our local schools. Let's use that to implement this blueprint.
I think that we would be, absolutely fine with that. We do believe that it is a way to offset. And I don't know, I know the federal funding at the ESSER II funding, et cetera, is going to be badly needed at the school districts. But I don't know if the governor could somehow and the legislature use some of the COVID funding coming into the state to do exactly what you're saying, Brendan. I mean, to fund what is in this blueprint in terms of special education, ECS, and, the mental health pieces, that would be absolutely ideal. Because, what Maureen is pointing out, I mean, the funding cliff that is going to happen in 2023 when the federal funding goes away is going to be pretty outrageous. And all of us are going to be very badly influenced by that if that's the way we go. And we've done that before, and we know how negatively it impacts us. So my guess, that would be phenomenal. I know there's a March 1st meeting of APPROPES, and we're all hoping to go to, or many of us are hoping to give testimony at that meeting to talk exactly to that, as to give testimony to the fact that the blueprint is an excellent alternative. And right. I know I'm talking too much, but I'm going to say one more thing. It's reasonable, guys. I've been part and parcel. I was superintendent in Bridgeport. I've been part and parcel of CGEF and other grant or other funding requests that were so out of line with what the state could possibly bring forward that they just went up in smoke. And I believe this is reasonable. people can get behind this. It is not, if you know Ted Sergi, you know, and Kathy Gay, they are reasonable people. They've put forward something that I believe we could live with and fund. And I just, I hope I'm going about it the right way. And I hope we are with, you know, local legislators and trying to talk to as many people as possible, trying to form as many coalitions as possible. But I would greatly appreciate any other recommendations. I love that one, Brendan.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I had John, right? John, were you?
Sorry, I was muted. I have a specific question on special education. This proposal calls for $70 million more than the current $140. What would it be to fully fund special ed, and why the 70?
I think the 70 is to fully fund the excess cost grant that we get right now, John.
Okay.
Right now, that excess cost is funded at about, not to confuse it, but about 70%, 72%. Am I right, Kathy? Somewhere around that. And this would be fully funding the excess cost. Within that, we're also looking for some carrots for districts to think about regional approaches with their RESCs for less, for more effective, less costly programs than sending out to private facilities. So there are several things within that special ed, but that is certainly one of them. And also working with Rose's office, and I did hear President Biden say that he was interested in more funding for special ed.
Okay, thank you. I assume then that we're being aspirational with this plan instead of just trying to keep the status quo. So we're definitely trying to move the bar, I hope.
We are.
Hopefully we can also change the burden of proof issue.
Oh, yeah, that's in there, too.
Yeah,
we would love to change the burden of proof. We've been working on it for a long time. We're also working with our delegation at the federal level. Now that, you know, this administration is in, we do think we could more easily update IDEA, and in that, we're one of about six states that have the burden of proof in the way it is, and we're hoping that that could change at the federal level too.
Great, yeah. I know that Maureen spoke before, but because you're from CAPS, I wanted to, was there something else you wanted to add to Fran's?
You know, and I'll be brief. I think what Fran is talking about and what I tried to allude to is the predictability that the blueprint would bring. We were supposed to get increases in ECS this year if that formula that they agonized about for a couple of years actually was enacted. Now it's not being enacted. So if we could at least go with a predictable plan like this blueprint to allow districts to plan, you know, we are always in conflict with our town. Oh, your educational costs keep going up, but we, you know, we have no way of knowing what kind of monies they're going to get in. And that excess cost grant has never been fully funded. If only they could live up to those predictable promises, predictable things that have been in the legislation for a while. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Terry, I see a lot of folks have questions.
I'll actually be quick. I know, Fran, I know that you had emailed Jan, our president, your PDF. Wondering if we could actually have a meeting with AFT, with our leadership, with you to talk about this issue in a little bit more detail and how we can, I think you want to get like kind of with ACR, you want to get more organizations a part of this. So if we could figure out a way to at least work with you on some parts of it, that would be helpful.
Yeah, I would love that, Terry. Jan did say that she was interested in that, and I'll make myself available and anyone else to come and meet with your leadership. Absolutely.
What other organizations have you met with, like in terms of, board of education groups? So, like,
okay. Well, I've met with CABE, I've met with CEA, I've met with AFT, I've met with CAS. I've met with some of the Faith Acts, which is a group that I know, Black ministers in Bridgeport and Hartford. I've met with, and the rest of the time I've met with legislators. I've been going to Board of Ed meetings at night to talk to Board of Ed members whenever I'm invited. And I've gone to all the legislative breakfasts that I've been invited to just to talk about it as well.
I would suggest, I don't know if you have or not, my husband works instead of Dems. If you talk to Looney and Duff about this issue, it'd be great to see that as well.
Yeah, not yet.
Okay. Did you hear about it? And he's like, no. I'm like, okay.
Because Matt Ritter said, you know, he was really interested in it, but he wanted us to work it through the legislature first in terms of the education committee chairs, et cetera. But you guys know when you're working with the legislature and you have a huge document like this, trying to water that down and get it in 15 minutes, which is usually the amount of time you get, is so difficult to bring it all forward. I've met with Bobby. Kathleen McCarty really gets it. She spent a great deal of time on it. But, you know, I'm not sure that the others do. I've sent it to them in PDF. I've sent it twice, sent it again after the governor's budget came out to say this would be a great alternative, and also sent them hard copies.
Wonder at a certain point, because it is such a huge document, to figure out what do you want to get in the next year? Like, what can we get actually voted on this year or have a public hearing? Because it is overwhelming to, I know you, it is a 15-year plan, but they want to know what are my three things I'm going to vote on and what's going to happen. How do we do it? I mean,
I have a Gantt chart that I can send to Brendan, which does talk about it talks about the priorities for this year and moves them out right through the 15 years.
Great. Thanks, Jerry. I think Lon was next.
Yeah. Hi, Fran again.
Hi, Lon.
A really great comprehensive document. You know, one thing I would just suggest when it comes to the carrots, that in addition to working with RESCs, that any language would also include boards working together. Because I think there are definitely areas where boards can create some programming that you may be on a smaller scale, depending on the situation and depending on the students, that might make sense. And I think there's a lot going on with that. I know we've been within our district, we've been doing that kind of collaboration, but also I think we're sharing transportation costs sometimes with other districts.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There's a lot of, I think there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of carrots to dole out. And sometimes I think the carrot might just be actually doing it because there's good savings. And I think there's a good opportunity for CAPS and CAVE and all of the other organizations that work with public ed to help facilitate that too.
Thank you, Lon. I'll make sure that I talk about that in addition to the rest, especially in many of the small districts. I mean, I know they're already talking with the ESSER funding, you know, to build some regional interventions. So I think that would be right up the alley. I think that's great.
And I think there might be some things to look at. I'm a broken record on this one, so I apologize to the Department of Ed folks on this. But there are some areas where some of the interpretations of federal law and district identification create complexity. So that might be an area where we can work together, too.
Yep. That's great. Thank you.
Brian?
Thank you. Thank you, Fran. Thanks for forwarding the report. One of the things I just want to kind of follow up on what John asked about the excess cost grant. What's driving special ed costs right now? You know, what was the major force between going from 11% up to 17%?
Well, you probably will get lots of different ideas on this. I would say from my vantage point in being my last assignment was in Bridgeport as interim superintendent for 3 years. And I would say to you that I watched kids being identified left and right because of trauma or whatever. But I felt that there weren't the interventions at the classroom level And we have something called RTI, Response to Intervention, where you move kids through a series of interventions prior to special ed identification. And that, I don't think that is operating well. And I think we need to re-examine that. I'm for every child that needs to have special ed getting those that special ed. But I do believe that in some cases we're over-identifying because we have not successfully put interventions in place. Sometimes, for example, in Bridgeport, I walked into a place that didn't have any reading teachers. How can you put interventions in place when there are no reading teachers to intervene with these kids? So I do think, and in the end, it's a whole lot less expensive to do that. So I think we need to look at that. We've also asked that, I've asked the legislature last year to put together a group of people to look at it and with timelines and make recommendations, because I do think there is some over-identification. I think some of the expenses that we are incurring in private institutions is incredibly, we can spend over $200,000 per child. And we also have the burden of proof. So it's complicated, but I do think that we need to really look at it and figure out why. Because our kids aren't different today than they were in 2011. Why is it that we are inching up in a Torrington, for example, up to 25%?
I think you may have answered my question. Maybe the staffing at some of the intervention level is one of the issues. Maybe where we put resources. But the other thing too is, can you foresee this, the intervention being kind of a regional collaboration on some level? And if so, how do you overcome some of the obstacles with mainstreaming or having, the student in the host school and being assimilated as best as possible? I think that's one of the issues we have sometimes when we look at these, is that the parents don't necessarily want their child out of district for a portion of the day and not be, assimilated.
Yeah, I think it's all on an individual level, and we have to deal with that. But I'll give you an example. When I was in Bridgeport, I worked with Brendan, who was Speaker of the House at that time, on and brought forward with the mayor a regional plan prior to special education, where students would, especially those that were having emotional issues, could go and receive intense intervention for part of the day or maybe the entire day for a week, 2 weeks, or 3 months. And the staff at this intervention site would work with the sending school to provide strategies. And the idea was that the child would come back in, but we would avoid the special ed designation or the out of district placement. And I do think that's happening in some places, the Farmington Valley. And I think we need to look more closely at it and figure out how we can make it happen. I'm going to tell you, it was really cost effective because if you identify a child in kindergarten and you're sending them out for services that are close to $100,000 a year, you're well over $1 million for that child before the child graduates. And I'm not on, and here's the deal, guys, I'm not 100% sure we're doing right for every child that gets identified.
Fair enough. I appreciate the comments, and on behalf of CCM, I think that's something that we would welcome the conversation to continue.
That's wonderful. I'm very candid, so I can tell you that. I get myself in trouble sometimes, but I do think that it's important.
Thanks again.
Thanks, Brian. Kathy? You're still muted, Kathy.
Okay. I still can't figure out how to unmute. You would think after a year of doing this, it would be simpler. Good morning, everybody. So there is an enormous amount in the package that CAPS has put together, and Fran was kind enough to share it with the department, and I know she's also shared it with the Office of Policy and Management. And I think that, you know, the nice thing is there are many things in there that, you know, are supportive and build upon the work that the department is currently doing and that, you know, we should think about doing in conjunction with our superintendents moving forward. So, you know, we're fortunate in that we have that partnership with CAPS. the dollar amounts we, you know, the legislature and the governor will in the end sort out what we are able to afford to fund. One of the things I would say is that, and I think that's important for our group to think about moving forward, is that as the state continues its investment in education, and we can argue about how much that investment should be and whether it's enough, but, you know, if we're going to agree to a plan, and that plan includes planned increases in funding over time, what is it that we as a state then would like to see as outcomes? And I say that because, you know, depending, one of the things I don't think that we, or maybe I should put it this way, I think varies greatly across the state is the ability for districts to determine whether or not how they're spending their funding is generating the outcomes that they would like for their kids. Because, you know, in the end, we all have the same goal, which is that, you know, our students do well and they go on to be productive citizens. So how do we think about that? Because we spend almost $10 billion annually on education in Connecticut. That's a lot of money. And arguably, there are not just in our urban areas. It's just that our urban areas, because there are large concentrations of poverty, they get a lot of focus. But statewide, we have kids that we are leaving behind and or that we don't really address their needs in a way that, you know, allows them to be successful once the K through 12 system is through. And I'm not necessarily talking about special ed or L or any specific population. I'm just talking about kids in general. So one of the things at the department that, you know, my office has been looking at for a while, and, you know, Representative, when you were Sharkey, when you were Representative, you know, your uniform chart of accounts, well, we've gotten there, finally. yeah, I was going to say. and we now have 3 years of, you know, school expenditure level data. We have data we didn't have. And we are starting to align that data. Many of you know my colleague, Ajit Gopalakrishna, with our accountability data. And, you know, trying to highlight where is it that districts are, you know, doing outstanding things and how do we replicate that? But I think that it's going to be very important if we're going to commit to an investment, an increased investment over time, that we help the districts navigate how is it that those resources can, you know, get to the kids in a way that is meaningful for the outcomes. And I'll use an example that I found kind of stunning. During the CJEF case, which I was one of the state's witnesses, I ended up watching it, which I don't know if anybody should ever sit through and watch a trial on education funding. And, you know, one of the witnesses that was testifying on behalf of the plaintiffs, you know, talked about how they had this terrific reading program and it had been going, they'd been doing it for years, but it hadn't changed the outcomes for their students. And, you know, and my first question, frankly, was, well, I get that maybe it's supposed to be a premium package, you know, educational package, but if it's not generating what you need, then you're spending money, resources, and people on something that doesn't necessarily move the, and is not moving the needle for your students. And so, you know, why is that, that that's allowed, you know, and why is it that that's not? And so, you know, I think in partnership, there are many amazing things in this plan. And I think that working together, we can help move forward, you know, the outcomes for our kids. But I do think that a part of our responsibility at the state level as fiduciaries is to ensure that those resources, you know, have meaning when they hit the ground. And I will, my personal op-ed, and I apologize, as a parent of a student who spent his entire, he was graduating this year, but it was the identified special ed student for his whole thing. I think you should poll the parents about burden of proof before we get too far afield on that. But that's just my personal thing. That is not the department. And thank you for listening.
Yeah. Well, I think we all know where the parents would be on that, but that's part of the problem. Like, you know, they have a tendency to overwhelm the system. Understandably, I get it, but, you know, we as Fran said, we're the only people, we're one of the only a few states that has a burden of proof the way we do, so maybe we just can't afford to be doing anything anymore. And we have a lot less litigation as a result. But in any case,
I'm not a question as much as a statement. You know, this is as from the REST perspective, REST Alliance perspective, and from CREC as a REST, we are wholeheartedly supportive of majority of this plan. Obviously, there's a couple things that we would want to tweak and work with everybody on, specifically as it relates to the magnet school tuition piece within the ECS formula. That's going to be an important piece for us to work out some of the kinks for, because it's not included, and we do need to think about that long term, because the magnet schools need to develop a sustainable financial plan as well in the region. So I'm very happy to support this as a RESC. This is something we are doing in many aspects of, but would like to continue to do more efficiently and effectively.
Thank you. Thanks, other comments or questions, Brian?
Yeah, I'll just say thank you to Fran. This is a really, I think, great base level document that, you know, really kind of charts out what the future of education in Connecticut could look like over the next, you know, decade and a half. And there's a lot of here, a lot of stuff in here that I think is really good. I would love to be able to see the Gantt chart. Just to kind of see the phase in timeline of this, because I don't know that there's a grand bargain to get all of this done at once. And I think you probably think the same way. So, you know, I'd love to see how that gets phased in over time. I'll probably say something that's probably unpopular among business managers along special education. I would love to see that $70 million dedicated towards the excess cost grant move more to incentives to create those, you know, kind of programs within district. It's something that we do here, and we keep a lot of kids in district. We only have probably 6 or 7 students outplaced because we spend a lot of resources within district. And we would love to be able to tuition, you know, kids in from surrounding towns. Part of the challenges that we've had is, you know, kind of startup costs there. And so if we can allocate some of that $70 million to getting programs going, I think that there'll be some kind of flywheel effect, and we'll be able to see kind of progress there if we were to do that. But otherwise, I think it's a great aspirational target for us to move forward with.
Hey, Brian, can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Given that ACIR is also recommended, and now the governor has also adopted our local government in the future bill, which is now House Bill 6448 at Planning and Development Committee this week, provide funding to the rests as well as the cons to offer programming that is otherwise being done on a district by district level. And that's kind of something that ACIR has championed for this year. To what degree are the programs you're describing capable of being done at the rest level in your region versus district by district? What's your...
Yeah, and I think it's contextual. We do send some of our students to CREC, specifically their autism program, and I know that's a great program that we have available to us. But there's also other areas that we see specifically SED, severe emotional disturbed kids that we have within our district that probably is our biggest driver. That if we were able to set up a program for that, that would be, helpful to us. And we've heard from our other surrounding districts that that's a need potentially there too. For us as a district that's actually growing, our biggest challenge is space. And so we don't necessarily have a place to put it. So that's one of those startup costs for us is, we've identified a couple of sites in town that we could put in. Could that be done theoretically at a larger level? Yes, it could, but the incentives have to be there all the way around.
Right.
Okay.
Thanks. John, do you have a?
Oh.
You're muted, John.
Sorry about that. In this discussion, I was having a flashback to the Moore Commission. And a group that we had put together specifically on special education. And one concern just with this discussion, and I don't profess to be an expert, but my recollection of some of the hearings we had there was with school-based systems that were set up that was similar to what was just described, seemed to be in, at least at that point in time, 7 or 8 years ago, in essentially competition with programs from the RESCs. And at the time, I wasn't really sure if that was the healthiest situation or the maximization of limited dollars, where a school district sets up a program to, under the good notion of keeping their students at home, but it would be that much better if they could recruit X number of students outside the district to come in, and then you have essentially a competitive situation between the RESCs and the schools. And I don't know if that is an issue, but I just recall that. And if we're going to be looking at this local government of the future, I hope that we are going to kind of resolve that so that we're greasing the right wheels, if you will.
Right. Thank you. Other questions for Fran? If there are none, I guess the question is for us as a subcommittee is what do we want to do next? Do we feel as a subcommittee that we have enough information and enough support from our membership to endorse this in concept and be willing to lend our and recommend to the full ACIR that, in fact, at our next meeting, which is a week from Friday, that we do so. And then in doing so, lend our voices or our collective voice to the efforts. Is that something that I think, does the group feel that we're ready to do? Our subcommittee members.
I was going to say, I think after getting some of the information today, I don't think we're ready to endorse the whole package as is today, but it is something that I think is a good foundation and something that we would consider in the future.
Okay. how do others feel about what we might ask the full body of ACIR to endorse or not?
Would it be helpful if we had the priorities here and we can look at that for our next meeting or discussion and then determine maybe at this point we're maybe not endorsing the whole package, but looking at the priority areas for this year and possibly next?
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a good point.
Maybe down to something that people can actually understand and vote on and move forward.
That's a good point, Deb. I'm glad you raised that. I was looking back through the report this morning and you know, one of the helpful things about it is that it does actually break down in, I think it's appendix D. I'm looking at it now. The specific recommendations broken down by different categories. And if I could, maybe I will. Allow me to share my screen real quick since I've got it up on the screen.
I think I just did so.
Okay, great. Thank you. So, So what you all are looking at is Appendix D of the report, which is the cash, and you'll see programmatically on the left and specific recommendations on the right, and it's broken down into further categories of educational equity you can see here. Intergovernmental stuff, accountability for continuous improvement. There are 30 recommendations altogether. And in addition, what I think we heard from Fran was that there, you know, the Gantt chart that she described, that kind of lays out a game plan, if you will, for a multi-pronged approach, a multi-year approach into how, what we can get done this year, next year, and beyond, I think might also be helpful to Deb's point, so that we can kind of get our heads around what it is that we're actually recommending or approving. We're an hour into our meeting today, is there logic to having this committee take some time now to go through those recommendations, or should we... what's going through my mind is that if we were to have another meeting of a subcommittee to kind of go into more granular detail about the recommendations, we're talking about, you know, a month or 6 weeks off before the full ACIR would actually get this presented to them for a vote or endorsement. And by that time, a lot of the committee work will have already been done. So our recommendations may not be quite as powerful as if we were to do something, say, next week with a proviso that we're going to, dig into it a little bit more deeply at a subcommittee level going forward. So I guess what I'm suggesting is, I think Deb's point's a good one, that we kind of need to understand some of the more granular details of this, but as a whole, could we come back to the full body next week and say, look, you know, we've had a conversation with Fran. We recognize that we need to do a little bit more of a deeper dive into these recommendations. But we could recommend to the full body that, that in principle we can endorse this concept anyway. And then lend our voices to different committee level discussions that may be going on. Marcia?
I'm just wondering if there couldn't be almost like a heat map applied to these initiatives that would give a priority order or that which is most feasible to implement first, the first steps before some others could be implemented. Those that would make the most dramatic impact, those that would start to open the gates to a more cohesive understanding of the challenges that education are facing that people are not comprehending. I just think when you look at this
there must be some things that could start to move the project forward that you could highlight for us, color code, highlight something so that we could take those and maybe mine a little bit deeper on how the best advocacy could work with the legislature and getting some movement in this, because it's year after year after year with no movement in education. And it just is, from my perspective, my community suffers greatly with it, with this, and the strings attached to the ESSER money don't do anything for us with what they're requiring. And I just think that it's either there's not, people aren't taking the time to understand these challenges and how significant they are to the future of education, or they're just don't want to use money for the benefit of education. I just think if we could kind of highlight those that are the most important first steps, it might be worth diving into those.
Marcia, I think you're dead on with that. And I wonder if maybe in light of the conversation that we had earlier in this meeting about taking advantage of the federal money that's coming in, the COVID relief money, you know, could we prioritize what you're describing, you know, in terms of the heat chart, to be actually focused on reimagining what we can do with the federal money that actually coincides with what the CAPS blueprint would propose, you know, and so you can put those priorities together with money that we know is coming, and that can be our goal for this year. You know,
the problem is that the ESSER money is very it's not fluid money. It is very. It's, to me, it's a waste of money the way they're laying it out there. And we need to fill holes in our budget and keep our teachers employed and keep our programs working. And every time that they dangle additional money out there, it sidelines the Board of Education, because we never know when it's going to be pulled away. And it's going to be then fall back on the town to try to fill that void. So I guess I don't fully understand how the ESSER money can be used. I just know there's a full depth of strings attached to that money, and I think every municipality may be needing to use it in a different way. I don't know, and I guess I would ask the educators here today to kind of explain to us how that could possibly happen.
Yeah, well, okay, educators. sorry, So Maureen, I got your email, so we can talk a little more about that, but go ahead.
Yeah, the ESSER money that was allocated to districts is very specific as to what it can be used for. It has to be to enhance programs for purposes of COVID recovery, and it outlines specific areas like technology, acceleration, family outreach, social and emotional needs. So it has to really demonstrate, and we are all completing a needs assessment right now, but it's very specific, and it really is going to be looking for us to enhance, not simply backfill our budgets with the money. So it really, the assertion by the governor that this money can kind of backfill the budget is just not at all accurate to what we're hearing from State Department officials, as well as what the federal government, I believe, had in mind. So, but all of the ESSER grant writers in your district by now would have received this needs assessment that needs to be completed by the end of March.
Right. There was some, I think someone else had a, wanted to raise a question.
I think Kathy did.
So the ESSER to the department and actually, the needs assessment that went out to districts, Fran and CAPS kindly put that together to assist the department in assisting the districts on thinking about how to spend these funds. The funds are limited in the sense that they are related to, they need to be related to COVID related, so expenditures that were created because of COVID. So I mean, kind of a simple way to think about it maybe is, you know, if you're expecting contractual increases for your teachers this upcoming year, that's not what ESSER II is really meant to be. If you need staffing because, you know, you continue social distancing, you need substitute teachers because you have teachers on medical leave or on leave because, you know, for COVID related and stuff, those costs absolutely would be acceptable costs under ESSER II. So it's, to Maureen's point, navigating it is kind of always with the vision of its relationship to the extra costs that districts are facing because of COVID related.
So thanks, Kathy. And so Fran, do you think that there is, is there a potential for taking your master plan and identifying, you know, first year or this year activities, which could cross with what is available from feds and kind of imagining how the federal money might be able to implement some of the things we're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm thinking of things like structural racism and the training. I'm thinking about distance learning. There are many things in there that we could definitely use some of the COVID relief funds coming in and begin to implement those. The thing that I worry about, even with staffing, guys, I have to tell you because I've lived through it so many times, is the funding cliff that comes in 2 years. That's my whole thing. And I so worry about that. But do I think that we can do some of this? Absolutely. And thank you for putting up the blueprint. That's what we're talking about in terms of the start date. And if you go down, some of it is very different. Some of it, you know, like in the ECS funding, we're saying, yes, we do believe that we can move forward with ECS, but look at it. It says the state must spend considerably more to meet a goal that the state and towns will equally share K-12 spending. That's agreeing to that, agreeing to the fact that the pie needs to be bigger, guys. You know, we've been at 41% of cost sharing with the state on the cost of educating a child for 30 years. It hasn't moved off of 41%. Most states are at half. We're looking for 15 years to get them to 47%. So there are lots of things here that could certainly, I mean, I could do it in more detail and I could have that to you where we could use some of the COVID relief funds coming forward. I also think there will be a large amount of COVID funds at the state level. Forget the district level right now, but at the state level, is there some COVID relief that's coming from Biden's stimulus package that could be used to fund some of the pieces in the blueprint? And, you know, like ESSER could not, but I'm wondering if there are other funding sources that could be used to at least begin the funding forward. I don't know how tight the regulations are on the stimulus money.
Yeah. So, Fred, it sounds to me as though that would be a useful, at least for us, based upon what Deborah had described, as a, not an obstacle, but as something that we need to do in terms of our own due diligence on this, that if you could fine-tune the blueprint so that there is a cross-pollination of your recommendations and what is doable with the additional funding that would be coming. That gives us a bite-sized set of recommendations that we could, I think, get behind in the short term, while also then spending a little bit more time in some of the deeper dives on some of the longer-term policy changes that are recommended, if that makes sense. Kathy, yeah.
Just quickly, for some context too, because I think sometimes this gets lost. Our districts are receiving anywhere from $39,000 in ESSER money to the $44 million that Hartford is getting. The vast majority of districts are getting ESSER funding that is less than $200,000 under the ESSER II. And, you know, that needs to carry them just in terms of meeting their needs. I can't imagine it will completely carry them through 2 years. But so when we talk about, I think that the conversation about the amount of the pool of money gets distorted a little bit because, you know, it is the top 10 that are getting the vast majority of the funding because it's based on Title I allocation. So, you know, we do have districts that are getting as little as $39,000 for that's available to them through the 9/30/23. So, and I don't know if it would be helpful to share with this group kind of what it looks like, but, that does change what it is that you could potentially do to offset the impacts that you have seen because of COVID, never mind even getting into what your normal operational costs might be. So I'm happy to share that if people would like.
Yeah.
And that's why, Kathy, I said we can't think about the district, but what about the state dollars? And I'm not talking ESSER dollars. I'm talking the new stimulus dollars coming forward.
And yeah. I don't know. I'll have to check in with OPM. I don't know how much. I mean, the governor did make the $159 million available under the coronavirus relief funds under the last round, but I don't know. I'm not aware, and I'll reach out to them to see if they're getting something similar, like an additional pool of funding.
That was my understanding, that the state was going to get a percentage of the total amount.
Yeah, that's what I of the new Biden stimulus, right?
Yes.
Oh, of the new. Okay, so not the one we just got.
No, mm-hmm. The new one.
Okay, I was gonna say I'm like I don't think, but I'm
no,
happy to
no,
ask.
The new one.
John and then Marcia.
I'm just curious as to the legislation that's pending now before education or appropriations or wherever. How does that relate to these proposals? Do you have a bunch of them out there, or how much of this initiative has been embraced this session?
You know what, John, if I can show, I will send along to Brendan. I'm sorry, I just don't have your email right in front of me, but Maureen has also the chart, Maureen, that Kathy Gay did, that shows all the legislative proposals and the correlation to the blueprint. It's about 2 weeks old, so, you know, things have grown since then. But you'll get a good idea that the majority of the proposals are already in the blueprint. But they're just not referenced as blueprint proposals. But you know, all of the social and emotional piece, you know, the acceleration piece, the distance learning piece, all of that is already in the blueprint. And many of the bills echo those.
Thanks. Marcia?
I was going to actually ask the same thing, so I'm fine.
Okay.
And then I was just going to ask Brian if maybe I know you shared some preliminary information through CCM, what you're hearing in regards to the Biden money, and I was hoping maybe you could talk a little bit if you've heard anything more about that funding, whether there would be strings attached, or is there advocacy that we need to do on the federal level to ensure that there won't be strings attached?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not quite sure what the exact dollar amount is, but we do anticipate that there'll be state and local money that will be coming through. Some will go directly to the cities, I think, of a certain size. The other, and I think it may be through basically the CBDG grants on some level, and then those smaller towns, it'll be pooled and disseminated through the state. As far as strings attached, I assume there will be some. You know, there always is. What they are, I'm not too familiar with, but I will look into that for you.
Great. Okay,
thanks. I am so sorry, but I have to run to another meeting.
I think you're older, yeah.
All right. I apologize, guys. I can't tell you how much I want to stay here and just take this through, but I'm willing to come back or do whatever is needed, and I certainly will look at it in relationship to the COVID funding. All right?
Great. Yeah,
thank you all, and thank you for taking the time with me and with the proposal. Greatly appreciated.
Thanks. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you. Bye.
So Maureen, if you know, if I could if I could summarize where I think we are as we reach our noon hour, you know, it sounds as though if there were a way to prioritize the blueprint's recommendations in such a way that it could work nicely with what we're getting at the federal level or what we expect to get at with the new COVID package, you know, that gives us something concrete to get behind. We will be, you know, not bucking, but we will be trying to encourage the governor's office as well as the legislature to consider a different approach to where this money's coming from and how it's going to be used. But I think if we have more specifics that we can, you know, pin that recommendation to, I think the better.
And I would, as Fran mentioned, we're going to send you the updated chart prepared by Kathy Gay as to the crosswalk between where current legislative proposals intersect with the blueprint, and that might help with prioritization as well. We haven't heard exactly yet what the amount of money is we're getting from additional stimulus. We know what we're going to get for ESSER. So those are two, you know, potential areas that can provide us some guidance.
Great.
So I can forward those to you once I get them.
Sure, that's fine, and or to Bruce.
Okay.
I'll be forwarding it to Bruce for mass dissemination, but yeah.
Very good, that's what I'll do.
Okay. So I think the committee is, the subcommittee, I should say, is going to pause a little bit on this until we get some of this information, and we can identify what we can kind of get behind, but what I'm thinking makes sense is if we can be prepared at next Friday's full meeting at ACIR to have a discussion with the full group as to whether we can report out on what the subcommittee's done. But then, you know, what I'd like to be able to do next Friday is have the full group kind of digest what it is that we've looked at and see if everyone's comfortable in, you know, lending our support to at least the short term of what's being suggested in the blueprint and, and to the extent that that coincides with what will be coming, you know, from the federal government. Is that a fair summary? Okay.
Is it possible for us to try to attempt to meet prior to next Friday's meeting as a group? With the whole group, for us to meet as a subgroup for an hour or so just to digest some of that stuff that she's bringing back to us prior to that discussion?
Well, the problem, yeah, I mean, in theory, yes, we could. The problem is that we are, as a, even though we're just a subcommittee, we are subject to FOI rules. So we would have to schedule and post and, you know, the fact that we
so we don't have the time to do that. Gotcha. Okay.
So that's why we set this time aside each month in case there's a subcommittee activity that we want to engage in at a set time. We can call a special meeting if we think that's necessary.
I just think given the timeline, it might make sense for us to do that if we have the capability for the majority of the members to meet, to make Friday's meeting more efficient, because it is going to be so complex already. And
yeah.
If we have a good portion of us have a good understanding of the content, then we'll make that conversation.
Sure. Bruce, what say you on that? Do you think we could pull together a special subcommittee meeting for sometime next week?
I think what I would recommend, if you can get the information that you need to see in the next day or two, so let's see, today's Tuesday, so see where you are as of maybe the end of Wednesday or early Thursday, and if you feel you have enough to warrant a special meeting next week, then we can do what's necessary to schedule that meeting. You know, what you want to avoid is what happened, when was it, the end of last year, when you had a special meeting of a subcommittee, and then something like 12 hours later, the full ACIR was expected to work with the recommendations they received. So if you can come up with something by, say, end of tomorrow, early Thursday, and then I can try to schedule a meeting very early next week, I think it's very doable and it would save you a month. That's very beneficial. But make sure you have what you need to justify it.
Yeah, great. John?
I would just suggest we, if this time works, just put one down for 10:30 or 10 o'clock next Tuesday, and if we need it, we hold it. If we don't need it, we cancel it. Because I'd rather know, like, right now and set my schedule than get something late tomorrow, and then things happen fast in terms of my schedule and probably other people as well. So it's easy enough to cancel. You just need 48 hours in advance to schedule.
Not that I'm the necessary party here, but I know next Tuesday is going to be difficult. I'm pretty much tied up all day. I'm sorry. I take that back. Because there was a schedule change this morning. My availability will be somewhat limited. We have to make a quick meeting. I've got an all-day obligation. But I can pull away from that. But not that I'm the most essential party to that. But maybe that's a good idea. Put a pin in 10:30 for next Tuesday, and then we can reschedule. Okay?
Will do.
Great. Okay, thanks, Bruce. All right, thank you all. I know I appreciate you all being on for this length of time, and we'll get some more information out to you all and potentially be back as a subcommittee next Tuesday. All right. Thanks, everybody, for your participation in input.
Very good. Thanks.
Thank you.